Welcome back to Jamie Oliver. Cindy Gallup is such a force, and I am so excited to have her on the podcast today, you guys. I really think you're going to get so much out of this interview. I first heard Cindy on a guest of a friend of mine's podcast, Lisa Carmen Wang, who is the Bad Bitch Empire. I was so impressed by that interview. Even though that interview was years ago, I always kept it in my head. So happy to have you here. Everyone, welcome Cindy Gallup.
And thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
I'm so excited to be talking to you. You have such a list of interesting and amazing accomplishments. I feel almost like a kindred spirit with you in a way. I love how you say you're the Michael Bay of business. You love to blow shit up. You love to not only question the status quo, but kind of break it, dismantle it. And I would just love for you to share all of your knowledge with, or some of your knowledge, we only have about an hour, with the listeners today. Something that really stuck with me from your interview with Lisa was when you were speaking about a New York Times article that said the happiest people are unmarried and don't have children. You are unmarried by choice, never wanted children, although I've heard you say in many interviews you love children, you just never wanted them for yourself. So I thought that would be a really interesting topic to start with.
Sure. So as you've observed, I am somebody who has never, ever wanted to be married, never wanted children. And I'm very glad that I always knew that, as opposed to finding out the hard way by having them. I am not a relationship person. I adore being single. I cannot wait to die alone. And I date younger men, casually and recreationally, for sex. And I'm deliberately very public about all of that because we don't have enough role models in our society, for women and for men, that demonstrate you can live your life very differently from the way that you're expected to and still be amazingly happy. And I'm one of the happiest people I know. And just to amplify this point, I was on a podcast some time back, which was specifically about startups and, you know, the stress thereof. And the interviewer said to me earnestly, "So Cindy, you know, given all the stress of building your startup, do you have a daily self-care practice to, you know, de-stress?" And I said, "Oh yeah, absolutely. I totally have a daily self-care practice. My daily self-care practice is I have no husband, I have no children." And, you know, I really champion this way of being because every force in popular culture combines to convince women that your path in life should absolutely be marriage and children. And by the way, that is also a given for men too. You know, there are many who end up in situations, relationships, marriages they don't want to be in simply because the bill of goods we've all been sold is what you do is you fall in love, you know, you meet someone, you fall in love, you get married, you have children. And honestly, I really encourage people to just take a long, hard look inside yourself and ask what really makes me happy. I would love people before they had children to stop and think, do I really want to have children? Because there are a ton of people out there with children who would actually rather not have them.
That's interesting that you say that. I think that's a conversation that is not necessarily had out of fear. I have a child and I'm so happy, but I can also see where people can have children and regret it, and they're too scared to say that. And I think that's a very necessary conversation for people to hear, because especially as women, all we hear from those with children, oh, when are you going to have yours? And your life is not complete until you have one. And this is the greatest joy, is having a child. And there's so much more to that that doesn't get spoken about.
Absolutely. And that is why, you know, there absolutely are surveys that demonstrate that 1/3 of parents wish they had not had children. Those surveys are, to your point, Jamie, by necessity anonymous, because that is the ultimate taboo.
Right.
To self-identify and say, I wish I had my kids, is a complete no-no. It's a no-no for men, but it's far more of a no-no for women. I really want women especially to get themselves out of that mindset. I'll tell you something interesting, by the way. This is something I only realized last year. But because of the way I live my life, I realized that my default setting when I meet anybody is that my first assumption is that they are not married and they have no children. So that's just what I assume because that's where I come from. So in fact, when you just said you had a child, I was quite startled because I just looked at you and I thought, she's not married, she has no children. I mean, unconsciously, but that's where I start. Whereas the opposite is true of most people. So people look at me, I'm 64, okay? So their assumption is I must be married and I must have children. And I make this point because that's very indicative, as I said, of the oiled grooves we live life in, where we default to a set of societally imposed assumptions. I would just love people to question that completely.
Yeah, and that's really insightful that you just kind of discovered that this year. I love how someone as filled with wisdom as you, you're still having insightful moments. And I think that's amazing. I was actually thinking back to one of my first jobs, and I was still in college. I was a veterinary technician. My coworker, who was 35, no children, not married. And I remember my mindset back when I was 18 years old, looking at her, feeling pity almost, and thinking she was lacking something in her life. And thinking, oh, when I'm her age, I'm never going to be single and, you know, no kids. Like, she's 35. And I think back now, at 18 years old, why was that even instilled in me? Looking at this single woman and feeling pity or thinking like that's lesser than. Ooh. Where did that even come from at such a young age for myself? It's not like my parents straight out said, you have to get married, you have to have children to have a complete life. That was ingrained in me just from society.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, that's emblematic of the fact that even today, when I say I have no children, I can still get one of two reactions. Either, to your point, pity. Oh, the poor dear thing. She never met anyone who wanted to marry her. By the way, not true. I absolutely had the opportunity to get married, did not want to. Or the reaction is horror. Oh, my God, how unnatural. A woman who doesn't want to be a mother, my God, freak of nature. And that's just honestly ridiculous. I mean, you know, not only do I not feel that I missed out on anything but not on children, I am ecstatic I never had children. I am so thankful I never had children. Again, I'm very public about this part of how I live my life because we all need to hear that a great deal more. Yeah. Similarly, again, to the point you were making, one of the best moments of my life was the day I decided that I was done with looking for the one. And I say that because from the moment we're born as women, everything around us conspires, you know, parents, family, popular culture, to tell us that our life must be a quest for the one. And what that means is, you know, in our teens and 20s, we go to every party thinking, will he be there? And I'm speaking heteronormatively because I'm a straight woman, but, you know, equivalent for anybody, whoever the one is. And what that means is, you know, first of all, you spend hours dolling yourself up with makeup and outfits and whatever to make yourself sexually attractive. You go to the party or the social event. This is a motivation that forces you to compete with other women, which is the dynamic that I deplore. Then, you know, at the end of the night, you trudge home going, oh, he wasn't there. Oh, well, never mind. Maybe next time. And so at some point in, and I think this would have been my early 30s, I just went, sod this. I'm not looking for the one anymore. Oh, my God, the relief. I could go to social events and enjoy myself because I was not, you know, looking around the room, checking out the men, wondering who was single, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so I really encourage women to try and rid themselves of that notion as well. You know, I'm that very rare person who has no desire whatsoever to be in love. And I have to tell you that when you decide you don't want to be in love, it strips the whole layer of bullshit out of your life. And it's so time efficient. I've been reading a magazine, okay, World's Magazine, say, and I come to like a big feature on relationships. I go, oh, not interested. I don't read that.
So how did you come to this conclusion that you don't want to be in love? Because that's even a step further than I think, you know, I think it's starting to become a little bit more mainstream where women are going, we don't need this bullshit of relationships. Like, a lot of women I know, including myself, have been unhappier in relationships than they have been single. And they're kind of just being single right now by choice. If someone who fits, you know, their standards or what they're looking for should appear, then they might be open to it. But I feel like a lot of women, myself included, still have this little notion like, maybe one day I will fall in love again, you know, with the right person. So I think that's so interesting that you actually just said, no, I don't even want that. So how did you come to that conclusion?
Sure. So there are a couple of responses there, Jamie, because first of all, I do have relationships, but not the kind that society considers the default. And what I mean by that is, as I mentioned, I date younger men, casually and recreationally for sex. I meet them on cougar dating sites. I have one fundamental criterion for the men I date. No matter how casual the relationship, they have to be a very nice person. I have fantastic radar for very nice people. I only date utterly lovely younger men in an atmosphere of mutual trust, respect, affection, liking. And as a result, ironically, my so-called casual relationships go on a lot longer than most people's so-called committed ones. By which I mean, you know, I've dated younger men over periods of 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 15 years. They may go on to date women their own age. They may marry women their own age. We stay friends because we like each other. We'll meet platonically for coffee or drinks or whatever. Then every so often, those relationships end, every so often, those marriages end, and they come back. But that does not fit into the relationship box as it is outlined by society. The other thing I would say as well is I have absolutely in the past been in what at the time I would have characterized as in love. With the benefit of hindsight, I now characterize that as infatuation.
Mm-hmm. Same.
Yeah. And, you know, again, with the benefit of hindsight over a long life and looking back, I have a very clear-sighted perspective on how much the notion that you are in love warps your perceptions of that other person.
Okay. Yes.
And in fact, I think the way I articulated it was you think you love them because they were special, but they were only special because you loved them.
Yes. Light bulbs going off. Yes. I'm questioning things like, does romantic love really exist or is it chemical reactions happening in my brain fooling me? You know, I'm questioning these things and going through long-term relationship after relationship after relationship, getting to the point of like 4 years, him wanting to propose or actually proposing and becoming engaged, but me realizing I don't want to be married to any of these people. I don't want to spend the rest of my life with any of these people. But then there's also the thought like, oh, but maybe if it was the right one, I would. And I just haven't found the right one. But the truth is like, maybe I just don't want to be married. But society still looks down on that. And it's so evident in events or weddings. And people will invite you if you're single, but you don't get that plus one because you don't have anyone you're quote unquote serious with, you know, or an exclusive relationship with. So I find myself being single among most of my friends who are either married or in a serious relationship at these events. I'm the single one there. And I think to myself, I'd love to have a plus one. I would love to just have someone there with me. But society thinks like, oh, well, if you're not serious, like we're not wasting a space on this person. I don't need to get to know this person. Like, what do you think of that? Do you think like, just don't go to that event or deal with it?
I think it all comes down to your budget. If you can afford casual plus ones at an event, you should totally allow casual plus ones. If you can't, I understand the thinking if you're worried about numbers. I will say that years ago, so in my past life as a high-flying, highly paid ad exec, because I'm now impoverished bootstrapping startup founder, but back in the day when I could afford to do this, I used to throw a massive birthday party for myself each year. I lived in downtown Chelsea here in New York in basically what was 3,800 square feet of raw space that I bought because it was affordable, then built an apartment in it, which I called the Black Apartment because the wall, ceiling, floor, all black. And if you Google the Black Apartment, you will see my old apartment.
Okay.
So every year I would throw a party for my birthday for everyone. And because the space was so large, and because I would throw the party from, say, you know, 7 till 8, and people cycle through. So probably about 200 people in total. But I said no plus ones unless they are, you know, they are your spouse or your long-term partner or you're engaged. And I was stringent about this. I said, you know, you're welcome to pitch me why you want to bring somebody, but generally speaking, you are not allowed to. I'll tell you why, Jamie, because the reason was my parties were legendary in their time and everybody really enjoyed them, because what that meant was I only invited people I knew personally and liked personally and was very fond of. And I have a very wide circle of friends. And so the guest list constituted people from all sorts of different walks of life and industries and so on. What I would say to people was, when you come to one of my parties, you are guaranteed two things. The first is that because every single person there is a personal friend, every single person is a very nice person, because that's my criteria for my friends as much as for the younger men I date. And secondly, you have something to talk about with all of them because you all know me. I'm the thing you have in common. So that's immediate icebreaker. And you will get on with everybody you meet because you all have me in common. And they did. And so people mingled, made new friends, made new romances, had sex in the bathroom. That should totally happen at a successful party, by the way. but it was because I was stringent about the fact that my guests were only people that I knew personally and could vouch for. So that was my thinking at the time.
No, that's an interesting perspective. And I agree with that in a sense of, like, if it's your wedding and you're budget conscious, of course you don't want a stranger there. Plus on top of, even if you're not budget conscious, it's your special day. You may only want people that you know there. That makes absolute sense to me. I do appreciate those times when I've been single and I do get a plus one, but I understand when I don't. And another perspective you're just shedding light on is that, yeah, if you're inviting someone into your personal space, like, you want to know who's in your home, you know, that's a very private space. So that makes sense as well. But going out to dinners and being the only single one within a group of friends and they all have their significant other there, and I ask to bring a date and I'm told no, because you're not serious with this person, I do admittedly feel a little discriminated upon because of my life choices right now, that I can't have someone there to pull my chair out or hold my bag or something just because we're not serious. But I guess it depends on the situation.
Yeah. But let me give you my perspective on the scenario you've just laid out, because, you know, one of my mantras is stay away from people and places and things that make you feel bad about yourself.
Yeah, that's smart.
I mean, I realize this may not be that easy in your social circle, but honestly, I would not go to those dinners if I were you. Why go to dinners? They're going to make you feel like the odd one out. Stay away from anything that makes you feel bad about yourself.
Smart. I want to talk about these younger men that you meet. So you mentioned earlier you meet them on a cougar dating site. Why do you specifically go for the younger ones?
So here's the thing. Everything in my life and career has happened by accident. Okay. I've never consciously planned anything. I began dating younger men by accident. And what I mean by that is, so many years ago, 20 odd years ago, I was running an advertising agency here in New York. And we were asked to pitch for an online dating brand that started in the UK and wanted to launch here in America and take on Match, which was a big player at the time. And in the advertising industry, when you pitch for a client's account, you have to experience the client's product and the entire competitive landscape. So we all had to online date. And this was 20 odd years ago, and nobody on my pitch team at the agency ever had, because it wasn't a thing back then. You know, online dating was just very in its very early stages. So the rest of my team on this pitch were all married, living with, dating. So they went online and registered themselves as fake personas. You know, they created false identities to experience the client's website, to experience other dating sites. I was single. You know, I thought, I've got to do this for business reasons. Why not do it for real? You know, why not find out what this whole online dating thing is all about? I got an avalanche of responses, very good for the ego, by the way. But much to my surprise, because I had not considered this as a dating strategy, 75% of those responses were from younger men. And the majority of those were from much younger men. And I suddenly realized that I was every young guy's fantasy. I was an attractive older woman, high-flying career, did not want to settle down, you know, didn't want to get married, didn't want to have kids. I just wanted to have some fun, which at the time, you know, I just started up this agency in the world's toughest advertising marketplace, Madison Avenue. I was working 24/7. Fun was severely missing from my life. So I thought, gosh, hadn't thought about this as a dating strategy, but that's how I began dating younger men. And as I say, it's just worked brilliantly ever since.
Good for you. I don't know that. I mean, I guess there's a few I can think of that have been older than me, but I kind of follow that trend as well. But kind of recently, I met someone who was over 10 years younger than me. And I'm still in that thinking like, okay, well, this can never be long term because I was figuring out all the numbers. Well, what's going to happen when I'm 70 and he's like 50 something, you know, and I kept doing that math and I was like, I have to end it. But this kind of just gives me a new perspective. It's like, take that long-term love out, take it out of the equation.
And see what happens, because I can tell you, I have friends who married younger men who are very happily married decades on. Age is irrelevant when you make the right match. You know, I mean, in my case, that's absolutely not what I'm looking for. And by the way, my largest age gap has been 34 years.
Wow.
So, and actually, many years ago, I've been going to the TED conference many years, and TED used to operate a thing called TED University, where they invited attendees to give short talks to the other attendees on subjects that might amuse, entertain, and inform them. So many years ago, I gave a talk for TED University titled, Why Older Woman Plus Younger Man is the Relationship and Dating Model of the Future. So I had a stacked out audience for this talk, as you can imagine. And I began the talk by saying, okay, let's get one thing out of the way right up front. Yes, the sex is fantastic. When you combine somebody at her peak, confidence, experience, knows what she wants, with someone at his peak, lots of stamina, very short recovery periods, that's a fantastic combination. But I said, the thing that I really appreciate this dating model for are things beyond just the sex. So, for example, I've found in the past that men my age or older tend to feel competitive with a strong, confident woman who's earning more than they do. Whereas, you know, if you're a younger man, you can't be competitive because we're in completely different life stages. I find, too, that they enormously value, you know, my career experience, the fact I can advise them on wherever they are at with work and careers and so on. When you have an older woman, younger man, you really flip gender dynamics in a very productive way because of your completely different life stages. Also, doing what I do, working at the cutting edge of the internet, my lifestyle is very much about being on top of trends and everything that's happening. And so I found that attitudinally, mindset-wise, I was more attuned to younger men than men my age or older. I'm also, I am a very happy, cheerful, positive, optimistic person. And I really find that, again, attitudinally, mindset-wise, that's much more in line with younger men than it is older men.
Yes, I find that as well. I have often thought maybe I'm just the immature one, so I need immature, younger energy. But I think throughout our lives, we can keep that wonder and curiosity and excitement, and not to put down older men, but they do kind of seem more boring and set in their ways. And I just don't have as much fun in life. And I think that's such an important aspect of life. But what I do struggle with is making sure I don't become almost like a caretaker or a mother figure if they're much younger than me, but also in maybe not the best financial situation, which I don't know how New York is doing these days, but it was way better for me when I was in New York with the finances and the men than it is in LA. But in LA, most of the guys out here who are younger are broke. I find myself in a position where it's like, well, I don't want to have to buy every dinner or pay for every vacation. And I did that for a while, but I kind of don't want to do that anymore. But then it's like, what am I left with? So how do you navigate the finances?
Sure. So first of all, because it's not a relationship in the conventional sense of word, and we interact mostly in bed.
Okay. There's some dinners happening. Okay.
No. I absolutely, they do go out with my younger men. And and I will pay. And that's fine by me because, again, I'm in a different place to them. None of them in any way are motivated by money in any form or other. You can suss out pretty quickly the ones who are, by the way. But also, you know, I date younger men who have good jobs and are happy to buy me dinner and insist on doing so. You know,
okay.
So I think it's very much a function of maturity. And you can have very mature 22-year-olds in the same way you can have very immature 44-year-olds. And so we're not doing things that beg the money question particularly. I'm very happy to subsidize the odd dinner or drink. But equally, you know, these lovely younger men, you know, also want to buy me dinner, want to buy me drinks, you know, want to give me presents. And that's very sweet.
It's not like that in LA.
Oh, my God. Right. You definitely need to come back to New York then.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Well, I want to shift gears a little bit. I heard you say in an interview, you were asked, how did you create this amazing life for yourself where you're doing what you love, what you want to do? And I believe your response was somewhere along the lines as if you didn't do it intentionally, you kind of went where life took you. So I'd love to hear about your journey working at an agency as an executive. I know around 45, you decided to leave that behind and start your own business. So take the listeners through that journey and what you were thinking throughout that.
Sure. And once again, you know, I would just say that everything has been accidental. And so leaving the corporate world was accidental as well in a way, because I basically turned 45 in 2005 and I had my very own personal midlife crisis in the sense that in the couple of years running up to it, I'd always thought of 45 as kind of a midlife point. Obviously, by the way, in the happy assumption one lives to be 90, fingers crossed. But in the years running up to my 45th birthday, I'd gone, okay, on your 45th birthday is the moment when you should pause, take stock, reflect and review, where have I been, where am I going? So on February 1, 2005, and that was the point at which I went, oh my God, I've just worked 16 years for the same advertising agency. Wonderful agency, BBH, you know, love them to death. I'd worked for them in London. I'd gone out to Singapore to help start up the Asia Pacific office. I'm here in New York because I started up the American office for them. But I went, I think it might be time to do something different. And then the problem was I hadn't the faintest idea what. So vast amounts of thought and angsting ensued. And eventually I went, if I want to review every possible option open to me for what is effectively the second half of my life, maybe the best thing to do is to put myself on the market very publicly and go, okay, guys, here I am. What do you got? And see what comes. So I took a massive leap into the unknown. I resigned as chairman of BBH New York in the summer of 2005 without a job to go to. And it was the best bloody thing that I ever did in my life. Because I am now evangelical about working for yourself. Too many people make the mistake of thinking that a job is the safe option. It's not. Because in a job, we're at the complete mercy of management changes, industry downturns, marketplace dynamics. I always say to people, whose hands would you rather place your future in? Those of a large corporate entity, who at the end of the day doesn't give a shit about you, or someone who will always have your best interests at heart, i.e. you?
I was wondering if you still felt that way in these economic times, because similar situation with myself, I was in a very male-dominated field. I was in commercial real estate at the corporate level. I was vice president of a company in Beverly Hills, and I did that for over 10 years. And I realized, wait, I just fell into this, but I don't love it. I quit. And I started investing in companies, one of them being a women-owned plant-based restaurant. I'm vegan, so it was aligned with my beliefs. And I loved that I was kind of putting my money where my mouth is. Like, these are my beliefs. This is where I'm putting my funds. And it's been such an amazing learning experience. It's incredible to work with a team of women as opposed to men, I have to say.
Yep.
And the downside to that is that COVID hit and we're in the restaurant business in Los Angeles. Everything got shut down. We have 4 locations, but for a while, and even till now, it's kind of like a bit of a struggle with the economy. And, you know, I look back and I'm like, I don't regret leaving the corporate world, but in this economical landscape, I'm not stable. Obviously, as any entrepreneur, we can't be guaranteed financial stability, but how do you reconcile that where, you know, you're leaving this terrible corporate atmosphere that was not for you. Awesome. That's a great, bold leap of faith. But then jumping into the entrepreneurial world where everything is so uncertain, it's amazing you get to have the flexibility, work for yourself, but you don't have that financial aspect there. What are your thoughts on this?
Sure. So what I would say to that is, and by the way, I am absolutely fighting a battle every day to build Make Love Not Porn, because I have a special challenges. Every piece of business infrastructure other tech startups take for granted, we can't, the small print always says no adult content. And that's all pervasive. Can't get funded, can't get banked, tons of problems. So I have a very challenging entrepreneurial life. But I have to tell you that I have to support myself alongside Make Love Not Porn. And I do that through paid consulting, speaking, and personal coaching. And so I coach many women, and I also coach men, by the way, but in this context, I coach many women who are bloody brilliant and have no idea how brilliant they are, because all their careers in the corporate world, they have been kept down by men, held back by men, had their careers derailed by men, been sabotaged by men, had their confidence destroyed by men. And obviously what I do as a coach is I absolutely give them that confidence back. But I've had occasion with a number of my coachees to tell them they need to get the fuck out of where they are. And the reason for that is because, and we have conversations where they go, well, you know, just 2 more years and I'll be in a position to whatever, or if I stick it out, you know. And what I say to them is, So I'm half English, half Chinese. My father was English, and his mother, my English grandmother, was an amazing woman, very formative influence on me and my sisters in our youth. And although she was Christian, she was a huge fan of Buddhism. And she used to quote these Buddhist proverbs at us. And there's one that she used to say that I've always remembered and that have since had occasion to quote to these women regularly. And the saying is, the fool says, evil cannot touch me, but drop by drop, the pitcher fills. And the point I make to people is, you may think you can stick it out in that company, but every one of those daily microaggressions, microsexisms, microracisms, microableisms, every one of those over time is destroying your soul.
Absolutely.
It's eradicating your confidence in what you can do. It is absolutely destroying you. Get the fuck out.
I've used that exact phrase in interviews. I said it was soul crushing, soul draining. There is systemic sexism. And as you mentioned, those daily microaggressions eat at you and eat at you. And it's like that frog in a pot and doesn't realize it's being boiled until it's too late. And it's like, that's what's happening to women in the corporate world. And I am a big advocate for starting your own business and leaving. But as I said, I also see the downside to it, because when in unforeseen circumstances, a job does provide a salary that you can count on. True, at their whim, they can fire you, but there is a sense of stability there. And I don't know that I know that entrepreneurism isn't for everyone. So who are we speaking to here? Who are the ones that need to get out, and what do they do?
Okay. Too many women are trapped in the old world order, white male dominated corporate world. And so they haven't realized how ripe every industry is for reinvention to the female end. So I encourage women to take a long, hard look around them at their industry sector and identify what they think is missing that should be there, what they would love to make use of, but they can't because nobody's built it, what they think they could uniquely bring to the table, and then start that. And the reason for that, Jamie, is because when you reinvent an industry through the female lens, you, and again, opportunities are so rife in every sector, because at the top of every industry is a closed loop of white guys talking to white guys about other white guys.
Yeah.
And those white guys, by definition, cannot innovate, because homogeneity is the opposite of innovation, creativity, and disruption. But they sure as hell can acquire innovation. So when you reinvent an industry, whatever aspect of it you choose to tackle yourself that you uniquely can, all you have to do is operate that business successfully for a relatively short period of time. And then giant company X will buy it from you for an absolute god and fucking shit ton of money. And that is the fastest path to wealth creation for women.
That's so interesting. No one talks about that. Men do this often where they create companies maybe too often with the intention to just have it acquired and make a ton of money.
Yep.
I don't think women are taught that.
No, exactly. That is why I wish to direct you and our listeners to a brilliant site called theygotacquired.com. So theygotacquired.com was started, I think, nearly 2 years ago now by the wonderful Alexis Grant, who got completely fed up with seeing all these Silicon Valley billion-dollar unicorn exits being celebrated. She started They Got Acquired to be a media center, a resource platform to showcase, celebrate, and advise on acquisitions and exits along a spectrum from at the low end $200,000 all the way to $50 million. The point being, at every point along that spectrum is life-changing money for founders. So I highly recommend that you and our listeners go to theygotacquired.com, sign up for their weekly email newsletter, because I've found They Got Acquired a revelation. Because what it demonstrates is that anything you start has acquisitional value for somebody. And Alexis's case studies are amazing. You know, last year, one of them was this man who started a design blog, you know, one-man operation, sold it to a tech company for $1 million.
Wow.
Then another case study was a group of founders started something. They launched it 1 week later, American Eagle acquired it.
Oh, my goodness.
There are many very different paths to business exits and acquisitions. And often, by the way, they actually allow you to carry on building the business while having made money out of it. You know, and so I highly recommend that you and our listeners check out theygotacquired.com, because, as I said, that is the path to wealth creation. And by the way, another piece of advice I give women is when you are looking around at your industry and you are identifying the female lens opportunity that you can capitalize on to start your own business, do that with something else in mind. So my dear friend Natalie Molina Nino, some years ago, wrote a brilliant book called Leapfrog, where she interviewed a ton of female founders, myself included, about all the challenges we faced and how we overcame them. And the book is called Leapfrog because the idea is that enabled the women who come after us to leapfrog those obstacles because we gave them the solution.
I love that.
So it's a great book. But in it, Natalie says this brilliant thing I quote all the time. Because you know how the standard recommendation is find your passion and build a business around it. And Natalie says, forget passion, find things you want to punch. And so what I recommend to women is I want you to get very, very angry. And I say that because we are never encouraged to as women. You know, nice girls don't do that. When you look around you at your industry landscape, what about your industry makes you red hot with rage? What fills you with fury and frustration every single day? Solve that, and I guarantee you millions of other people will pay good money for that solution.
That is genius. Why is it so important for women to make, what is your phrase? A shit.
An absolute goddamn fucking shit ton of money. That is how I deliberately articulate it, because that is how much money I want all of us to make. And the reason is, when we make an absolute goddamn fucking shit ton of money, separate to, that's great for us, we can then use that money to fund other women, to help other women, to support other women. We need to build our own financial ecosystem because the white male one is not working for us.
I absolutely agree. Now, for those who are still maybe in the corporate world, still working, I know that you did an article with Bustle about how anyone can get a raise. And then did that kind of lead to the Cindy bot where on Facebook, people were able to just throw out any potential roadblock that a boss might put up when you do ask for a raise, and that Cindy bot could then give you the best thing to come back with? How did this even start with you, with, you know, teaching people how to get raises?
Well, I've just been speaking about that publicly for years. And the Cindy Botti reference was a fantastic exercise by the digital agency RGA several years ago, the Equal Pay Day, where they used AI to literally create me in a chatbot, which lived on Facebook Messenger or Cindy Gallup. And it was just, I mean, it was literally my tone of voice. You know, there was a warning. You're going to hear a lot of four-letter words. And what it did was it pulled data from a number of organizations, Ladies Get Paid, I can't remember what the others were. But and so what that meant was you could ask me advice through this chatbot. And, you know, I would say, okay, you know, what job do you do? You know, you might say I'm an art director. Where are you based? You enter your zip code. And then I would go, right, the average salary for an art director in that zip code is blah. But you're not average, are you? So we're going to ask for a damn sight more. And there are a number of options where people go, but what if they say this and I answer? And unfortunately, CindyBot was deactivated a year or so ago, basically because one of the data sources, I think the company closed down. And so it wasn't able to keep pulling the data. And I do wish that someone would start up again, because a lot of people, especially women, said to me that was a fantastic resource.
Yeah, I wish maybe someone listening, maybe that's the problem you can solve, is let's get CindyBot back into the universe, because the women could really benefit from that. So I want to get to your creation. You are founder, CEO of a company called Make Love, Not Porn. You've done a TED Talk about this as well, which I found so interesting. Let the listeners know a little bit about this company and what led to its creation.
Sure. Well, like everything else in my life, it was a complete and total accident. I did not intentionally and consciously set out to do anything that I very bizarrely find myself doing with Make Love, Not Porn today. It came about precisely because I date younger men. And 16, 17 years ago, realized through dating younger men that when we don't talk openly and honestly about sex, porn becomes sex education by default in not a good way. And so 15 years ago, pure as a little side venture, I put up on no money a tiny clunky website at makelovenotporn.com that in its original iteration was kind of a public service announcement. The construct was porn world versus real world. Here's what happens in the porn world. Here's what really happens in the real world. I launched at TED in 2009. I became the only TED speaker to say the words, come on my face, on the TED stage. The talk went viral as a result. And it drove this extraordinary global response to my tiny website that I had never anticipated. Thousands of people wrote to me from all around the world, young and old, male and female, straight and gay, pouring their hearts out, telling me things about their sex lives and their porn-watching habits they'd never told anyone before. And I realized I'd uncovered a huge global social issue. And so that was the point at which I went, oh my God, I now have a personal responsibility. I have to take Make Love, Not Porn forward in a way that will make it much more far-reaching, helpful, and effective. And so I turned into a business designed to do good and make money simultaneously, which, by the way, is what I believe all business should be ultimately. And so today, Make Love, Not Porn is pro-sex, pro-porn, pro-knowing the difference. We are the world's first and only user-generated and, importantly, 100% human-curated social sex video sharing platform. So we're kind of what Facebook would be if it allowed you to openly, healthily, sexually, socially self-express, which it clearly doesn't. The way to think about us is, if porn is the Hollywood blockbuster movie, Make Love Not Porn is the badly needed documentary. We are a unique window onto the funny, messy, loving, wonderful ways we all have sex in the real world. And what we're doing is we are socializing, normalizing, and destigmatizing sex out of the shadows into the sunlight to promote consent, communication, good sexual values and behavior. We are literally sex education through real-world demonstration. And I foresaw the creator economy 15 years ago when I conceived Make Love Not Porn's revenue-sharing business model to democratize access to income. So our members pay to subscribe, rent, and stream social sex videos. Half the income goes to our contributors, who we call our Make Love Not Porn stars. And as a unique business, we have a unique capability. We have the power to change people's sexual attitudes and behavior for the better. in a way that nothing else can.
It's so needed, especially now, because we see these sites like Pornhub, they're getting billions of views. Okay. So I am so scared about, especially this younger generation, thinking like, this is what sex is. This is how we treat women. This, and even women thinking, this is how I must act in the bedroom. And I was kind of going through your website last night for Make Love Not Porn. And there was like a blog area where people could write in. And one really struck me. And it was this woman who was thanking you and the website because she was with her husband. And her husband said to her, I really don't like how I feel like I'm having sex with a porn star. But she thought that's how she was supposed to be having sex because that's all she saw. And through your site, she learned a different way. And he's happier. Mm. She's happier. And that just kind of struck a chord with me because it's like, how many women and men are watching this and thinking this is what sex is? And it's just so impersonal. And a lot of, most I think of these performers are taken advantage of. You pay them half and the site keeps half, which is an amazing business model. It's so fair. No one is taking advantage and people are doing this willingly. What is going on with the addiction to porn and how can your site help overturn that?
Do you know, this is exactly why Make Love Not Porn is so necessary. Because I'll tell you something very interesting, Jamie. I decided Make Love Not Porn to be fully diverse and inclusive. And we are. Our members are Make Love Not Porn stars of all ages, male, female, trans, non-binary, straight, LGBTQ, asexual. We're a global platform, all races, ethnicities. But in the 11 years we've operated as a business, we've observed that Make Love Not Porn is especially a revelation to men. More men send us grateful emails, leave appreciative comments than anybody else because we are something unique that men will find nowhere else on the internet, which is a safe space where men can be and watch other men being open, emotional, and vulnerable around sex. You would not believe the number of men who write to us directly and say, I just watched my first video on Make Love Not Porn and afterwards I cried. I've said for years, I wish society understood the opposite of what it thinks is true. Women enjoy sex just as much as men, and men are just as romantic as women. Yet neither gender is allowed to openly celebrate either fact. We'd all be better off if they were. I picked up a wonderful Twitter exchange a while back between two men. The first man had tweeted, as a joke, obviously, hey guys, I've got this really weird fetish. I've got this kink where I want to watch porn where people are honest, loving, loyal, decent, and really like each other. And another man replied and said, there's this website called Make Love Not Porn where you can watch real couples making love. He said, I watched a video where the woman said to her man, I love you, while they're making love. He said, sincerely, I cried when I heard that. Make Love Not Porn is one of the solutions to toxic masculinity. And I do just want to seize this opportunity, Jamie, to say to you and our listeners, the reason we have not been able to have the big impact we want to is because nobody will fund us. Among the battles I fight is trying to get investors where nobody wants to touch anything to do with sex, even when I point out all the social benefits. So we have just launched our first ever equity crowdfunding campaign for Make Love Not Porn on WeFunder. And it's led by the wonderful Jameela Jamil, the actress from The Good Place, She-Hulk, because she's a huge fan. She's led this investment campaign. And I would just say to our listeners, if you like what I'm doing and want to see it have the global impact we want it to have, please do go to wefunder.com/makelovenotporn and invest in Make Love Not Porn. Minimum investment is $100. So it's very affordable. Participate at whatever level you would like to. Obviously, the more the merrier. But we would really appreciate help from your listeners, because as a sex tech venture, we have a whole bunch of extra barriers and challenges to overcome every day.
That is fascinating. And the fact that someone can enter with just $100, it's such a great idea. Is that an equity investment or what exactly is that?
So on WeFunder, and by the way, all of the information and the FAQs are there, but WeFunder operates as what is called a SAFE, which stands for Simple Agreement for Future Equity. So basically, you're investing, and then when we raise the full round we're looking for, we're targeting $1 million on WeFunder, but I'm working to raise more than that to really build out all of our plans. So when we have a full raise, then what you invest translates into equity in the company.
I'm going to invest.
Yes, please. Fantastic.
I'd love to support that and be a part of what you're doing. I think it's so helpful. It's so needed, especially in this day and age. I really think it can transcend more than just this idea about sex. It goes to how people are treated and violence and women's rights, like so many other things, this can help. So I do think it's really important. So thank you for doing that. And thank you for telling all of our listeners about that opportunity. That's amazing. Where do they go again to invest?
So they go to wefunder.com/makelovenotporn. And by the way, what this investment, this crowdfunding campaign will help us build is what I've had in the pipeline for years, which is the 0 to 18 and beyond sex education expansion of Make Love Not Porn, makelovenotporn.academy. And if you and our listeners go to that URL, you will see my full vision laid out there. But parents and teachers have been begging me to do this for years. Again, infuriatingly, I've had challenges raising funding. Even though it's sex education, investors still won't touch it. And so our WeFunder campaign will enable us to build makelovenotporn.academy and launch it into the world.
As a mom to a 10-year-old, we recently been getting into watching sitcoms together at the end of the night when we wind down. And it's older sitcoms that we can find on streaming networks, something like that was on CBS or, you know, NBC. And it's supposed to be funny and family oriented, but every other sentence is about sex or a joke about sex. And here I am watching this with my 10-year-old, and it's supposed to be appropriate for a 10-year-old. But I'm questioning, like, does she even know what they're talking about? Does she know what this joke means? At some point now, I need to have this conversation, which all parents, you know, reach this point, like you have to have the conversation. So would this provide tools for parents?
Absolutely. That's what it's intended for. I want to build the academy on the same principles of Make Love Not Porn. User-generated, crowdsourced, curated revenue share. So I'm not about reinventing the wheel. This is an aggregation play. I want to build the go-to global hub for the best of the world's sex education content. And so when we can build it, we invite sex educators all around the world to share with us their own content. You know, coursework materials, books, videos, comic strips. And I use educator broadly. Sexual health, the wellness experts, therapists, anybody informing and educating in this entire area. We will curate, you know, again, humanize, vet every piece of content on Make Love Not Porn and on the Academy. We make sure it's safe. We endorse it. And we will then publish it segmented by age appropriateness. So if you're a parent freaking out going, oh my God, my 6-year-old just asked me this. What am I saying? You will find entirely age-appropriate tools and content to have that conversation with a 6-year-old. But what I want to do, Jamie, is I just want to give you the 2 pieces of advice that I give all parents and have for 15 years because parents write to me all the time. And again, the great thing about the Academy is that when it's built, I can put this all there and then point them to it. But the 2 things I say to parents are, number one is, these days, you cannot begin talking to your child about sex too early. And when I say that, I don't mean they should talk about sex. What I mean is the very first time they ask where babies come from, the most important thing isn't even what you say as much as how you say it. Never, ever get visibly flustered. You know, never get embarrassed, never get angry, never shut the conversation down, leave the room. Instead, answer calmly, straightforwardly, truthfully. And you will open up a trail of communication between you and your child that will always be there for them as they get older. And the thing that matters to a parent more than anything else is that their child be happy. This area will impact your child's happiness more than virtually anything else. And then the second thing I say to parents is, today, when you talk to your child about sex, you must also now talk to your child about porn. And this is a lot easier to do than most parents think, because all you do is a version of what I'm about to share with you, and you dial it up or down depending on the age of the child. So you go, darling, so we've just talked about sex. And you know how together we watch movies and videos and cartoons where things happen that aren't real. Well, there are also movies and videos about sex, and they're not real either. And because of that, they can be quite confusing. So we'd rather you didn't watch until you're older. But if anybody ever shows you anything like that, or you stumble across it, come and talk to us, come and talk to me, I can explain it. That's all you have to say. You can end the conversation right there. Because just by saying that, you've done 2 very important things. The first is that you're set up in their minds for when they stumble across porn, as they will, that it's not real. And the second thing is, you've said, come and talk to me about it. And you'll want them to do that because what they stumble across may be utterly traumatizing.
I appreciate that advice more than you even know. It sounds so simple, but we're not taught that. So we don't know how to approach that with our children. You know, a lot of our parents are either ashamed or nervous or, you know, just very uncomfortable to talk to us when we were kids growing up about it. So then that just continues. And that's why we have this whole stigma around it and confusion. And thank you again so much for that advice, but for everything today. It's just been so wonderful to have you here. Where can people find you?
Sure. So I'm at Cindy Gallup on Instagram and Twitter, and we are at Make Love Not Porn. You can follow me on LinkedIn. You can follow me on Facebook. Also, I have a Substack called Dear Cindy, where you can ask me anything and I answer a question a week. So do sign up to that. Obviously, please do come and join us at makelovenotporn.tv, listeners. You might want to consider becoming a Make Love Not Porn star yourself. And I would love, obviously, everyone listening who supports what I'm doing to help fund it at wefunder.com/makelovenotporn.
Thank you so much, Cindy. You're such an amazing person. Thank you so much for being here.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Jamie. Thank you for having me.